Tonight, you are getting a giant chunk of history thrown at you, and so I will make it interesting, I promise, but hold on to this because it's a really important idea. So, I want you to think back to 1938, the world was about to go into war. World War II starts in 1940-ish. 1938 is a couple of years before that. Hitler had been in leadership in Germany. The Nazi Party had taken over leadership in Germany about five-ish years prior. So we are in the ramping up moment where World War II is almost certainly going to happen, and it's becoming obvious to everybody around that something bad is just on the horizon. Now, from that point on, under Hitler's leadership, the Nazi Party committed atrocities almost without comparison in the world. There are probably, in the history of the world, 2 to 3 moments in history that were as bad as Hitler's work through the Nazis in the world. For example, in 1938, he invades Czechoslovakia. A year later, he invades Poland. He's trying to stretch his empire all the way through Europe. And in the process, when we get to 1942, he had 19 different operations. He called them operations. They were really massacres. Every single one of those massacres, Hitler sent his men in to kill somewhere between 500 and 3,000 non-combatants in a day. So in those 19 individual days, somewhere around 40,000 people were slaughtered. Between Hitler's rise to power and the end of World War II, I did a quick tally this afternoon to try to see about how many people I could figure out were slaughtered by Nazism. And I kept adding until I broke the 20 million mark. And then I just stopped adding. So somewhere at least in the vicinity of 20 million people were slaughtered by the Nazis for being born in the wrong country, for being born to the wrong parents, for having too high an IQ, for having the wrong set of beliefs, for being disabled. For all sorts of things, Hitler slaughtered men and women and children day after day after day. And what I find fascinating about this moment in history is not the atrocities of Hitler, but what happened, as I said, in 1938. 1938, Hitler takes his first aggressive move. He moves into the Rhineland, getting ready to move into Czechoslovakia. And in this moment, he overextends himself. And what's fascinating about this is England knew that that Hitler was overextending himself just a little bit. And so there was this window of opportunity where the English government could have shut Hitler down permanently. They could have avoided the entire World War II issue in about 2 weeks. Because Hitler's troops were not well trained enough yet. They didn't have enough equipment yet. They were too spread out. The English army and navy were at their peak, ready to go. Except they had decided to embrace an approach that even at the time, they called it appeasement. Appeasement. The idea was, if we will just give Adolf Hitler a little bit of what he wants, he will stop wanting anything else and he'll give up. You know what? If we just let him take a few countries, he'll be satisfied and he'll stop trying to conquer the rest of the world. Does this sound like a good plan? No, right? Like, this is an awful plan. But this is what they decided to do. And so at the time, the British Prime Minister's name was Neville Chamberlain. What is fascinating is that Chamberlain and his predecessor had been receiving reports from Germany for about 5 years about Hitler's intentional steps to becoming an empire that was poised to conquer the world. Way back in 1933, the reports started, and they would be things like someone in Germany reporting, hey, Hitler is building way too many submarines for any peaceful country to possibly want. Hey, Hitler is building five times more warplanes than anybody else in the world. Hey, just so you know, Hitler's manufacturing dozens and dozens of warboats that he can send out at a moment's notice. Hey, just so that you guys know, and these reports are coming in over and over again, just so you know, Hitler is training a vast army. Basically, every young man in the country is being trained to be a warrior. These are not the things that are being going to be done by a peace-loving leader. We need to stop. And all of these reports were flooding into London. And the executive leadership in London, the leadership of the country, made an interesting decision. They decided to not tell anybody. They decided to suppress the information. They didn't even give it to the House of Commons, their kind of version of the House of Representatives. They didn't even give it to the representatives. They just sort of suppressed it, said it wasn't happening. They tried to ignore it. Have you ever in your own life decided that, well, maybe if you don't go to the doctor, you're not sick? Anybody had a moment like that? Anybody know somebody who had a moment like that? You know what? If I just don't get it checked, it probably won't be anything. Before you look down your nose at the English leadership at the time, make sure you haven't done the same thing, because I think we're all tempted to be avoiders in certain circumstances, right? And that's really what they were doing. They were avoiding. And so, as Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia, the British government argued that they couldn't increase the size of the army because they didn't think it was a wise decision to raise taxes. A year later, when Hitler invaded Poland, England willingly chose to let its navy and air force lag behind the armed forces of the Third Reich because they didn't want to deal with the reality that they were faced with. Only one person stood against the policy of appeasement. His name was Winston Churchill, and he was hated and scorned for it. Why? Because the United Kingdom politicians had been lulled into a political sleep. You see, not even a generation earlier, there had been a war that had shattered the imaginations of everyone who participated in it. It was a war on a level. Before that, when countries went to war, sometimes in a battle, like 20 or 30 people would die. Maybe 100 people would die. In World War I, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of soldiers died in battles. It literally shattered the global imagination. And everybody just decided, no, we never need to think about war. We just can't think about it. War is an unimaginable evil. Anything is better than war, even letting Hitler do whatever he wants. So they were just dealing with the fact that they had never processed this. And then the leaders' lives in England, they were generally living fairly safe lives themselves. The danger was, well, it was far away. It was still pretty invisible to them. And there was a status quo. Several times during this time, leaders actually wrote down in their journals, in their diaries, for all of posterity to mock, something might need to be done, but if I'm the one who raises the alarm, I might not get reelected. So maybe I should just go with it. That sort of sentiment was the reigning sentiment in appeasement. And so these leaders, for 8-ish years, basically told Hitler he could have whatever he wanted, do whatever he wanted. And as we continue our series on prayer this week, I want to talk about a kind of prayer that releases the power of God, not only in our lives, but in the lives of the world in ways that it is desperately needed. And I start off with this idea of appeasement, because in actuality, the British leadership had decided to sleep through the problem, right? Like, they were just completely asleep on the job. And so they were able to just ignore everything they needed to ignore. They just kind of pretended it wasn't happening. If you think of what the word alert means, they were everything else. And they were profoundly unalert. In those years of intentional ignorance and blindness, it was only Winston Churchill who regularly stood before the House of Commons, the English legislature, calling for a change in policy. Over and over again, week after week, month after month, year after year, as everyone around him happily slept through the prelude to the worst conflict that Europe would ever see, Winston Churchill stood up and said, no. He once said about appeasement in the House, he said, appeasement is hoping that the alligator will eat everyone else first. And that was his stance, was no. We can't feed Hitler everybody else, because when you feed the dragon just gets more hungry. And so he stood against it. And he made a decision early on. He decided to gather to himself any like-minded men that he could find who would become his informants. By 1938, he may have been the most well-informed man in the world, because he had decided that any person in the media whose story was getting suppressed by the national government could come to him and talk. And any low-level politician whose ideas were getting squashed by their superiors could come to him and talk. And any diplomats from any foreign countries where bad things were happening, whose reports were being ignored, could also pass their reports in to Winston Churchill, and he would listen. And so he would get up in the House of Commons with these reports that the government had intentionally suppressed, and he would pull them out and say, here's what you just got told. What are you going to do with it? And they would have no idea how he got the information. And they would pretend the information, they actually would go on record saying that it was all lies, even though they knew that they had it on their desk. But when the moment came, Churchill had made sure he was informed. I find all of this very, very important, because one of the words that is often associated with prayer in the Bible is the word alert, as in stay alert. For example, in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 18, it says, pray in the Spirit at all times and on every occasion. Stay alert and be persistent in your prayers for all believers everywhere. Colossians 4, 2, it says, devote yourselves to prayer with an alert mind and a thankful heart. Stay alert. Be alert. Pay attention. Be awake. I don't know what you picture when you think about prayer. But for many of us, what we picture is getting down on our knees, closing our eyes, folding our hands, and praying. And there is nothing wrong. It's a wonderfully focusing thing to kneel down when you pray. It helps you remember that He's God and you're not. It helps you to remember that you need to be humble and He does not. That this is not a peer relationship. You don't kneel in front of your friends, right? You kneel in front of someone who is infinitely more powerful than you. So there's something wonderful about kneeling, and there's something wonderful about praying with your eyes closed as well. I don't know about you, but I am a profoundly distractible human being, and I need to do everything I can to reduce distraction if I'm authentically going to pray. And so my phone goes off. A lot of times I'll put the lights down. I will try to get someplace where there's not, like, I want to get away from, like, family. I want to get away from work, like, I was telling somebody the other day, there is a spot that I won't tell you. I told you guys a lot of times I pray here in this room. There's a spot in Lynn Woods I won't tell you about that, like, as a last-ditch effort, I go there. And I go there because it takes a really long time to get from any entrance of Lynn Woods to there. So the likelihood of bumping into somebody there is really low. And sometimes I just need to focus. And so closing your eyes and kneeling down and folding your hands, again, it's this gesture of supplication, right? This is what you do when you are pleading before somebody who is more powerful and authoritative than you. And we need to physically remind ourselves about the relationship we have with God, and praying and kneeling and closing our eyes and folding our hands and bowing our heads. These are all great ways. But have you ever thought about what else those things sometimes communicate? Could there be any less alert way of praying that to the world around you? Because what we're doing, right, we're shutting the world out when we pray. And for a lot of types of prayer, that is exactly right. We talked about devotional prayer a couple of weeks ago, and in devotional prayer, you are trying to shut out the distractions. But tonight we're talking about a different type of prayer, a type of prayer that's called intercession. In intercession, you do not, figuratively here, close your eyes. You don't bow your head away from the world. You don't kneel down so that you can stop being distracted by the world. You don't try to get someplace outside or away from the world. In intercessory prayer, you are cultivating an alertness in prayer. That's what these verses say. They say, be alert, stay alert, pray with an alert mind. Intercession demands alertness. But first and foremost, like, what is alertness? What does that actually mean? I caught a sense of alertness last night. My kids go to Sacred Heart School here in town, and they had, did anybody else do this when you were a kid? The bridge that you make out of like toothpicks or whatever, and you see which bridge can hold the most weight. Did anybody else do this? I had to do it out of a pound of macaroni. My school gave us a pound of macaroni and glue, and they said, you have to build whatever kind of bridge you can, and it's going to be a contest, and whatever bridge, and they would hook like a rope around the bridge, and then there's a bucket underneath it, and they keep putting weights in the bucket to see how much weight your macaroni bridge can hold. And so it was, I don't know what you're supposed to learn about this, but I remember enjoying it because it was more fun than doing worksheets with trigonometry on them. But so my kids were doing their school program. It was an art night, and then there was this bridge competition and whatever, and we're there. And I was in this room with probably 60 or 70 adults and probably 20 or 30 kids, and there's some random kid on the microphone announcing whose bridge is currently winning. And there's three different stations where bridges are being crushed by giant weights, and lots of kids running around for like to, there are like a bunch of science fair exhibits on the edges and whatever, and all the parents are like glued to the action. Like, because presumably it's their bridge or their kid's bridge, or let's be honest, they probably built the kid bridge for their kid or whatever. But everybody's like paying attention, and I watched myself not actually paying attention to the action. I was paying attention to the people who were paying attention to the action. I was on high alert for what was going on in the room. What's going on here? What? Who's where? What's the situation? Any guesses why I felt like that in that room? Because every Sunday morning, I am in the back on high alert, making sure that I know what's going on in the room, right? Like, I have trained myself in this so that when I walk, it's very funny, I can't walk into a room with a bunch of people without automatically going into high alert mode and saying, okay, what's going on? And walking in ways that intentionally give me, like, a view of who's where. And one of the teachers caught me doing this and, like, gave me this look like, what are you doing right now? And I hadn't even caught it. That was the moment I realized. I was like, oh, I switched into, like, alert mode to just pay attention to what's going on. And part of that was reasonable. I had two children running around in a room with no actual supervision, just people breaking bridges. And I wanted to make sure that neither of my children prematurely broke a bridge that somebody else had worked quite hard on. But I found it interesting. That's alert, right? High alert is the status that we jump into when we're just trying to pay attention to everything around us. And it is not a thing you are born good at or not born good at, or at least not only that. It is a skill that you cultivate. Alert is a skill that you cultivate. You have to pay attention to everything that's going on around you. Now, I've noticed this with my daughter. My daughter, just the other night, she had a bunch of like stickers, and she stuck one on my son's back that said, "No whining." This is never a kind thing to do. And I said, no, Hannah, we want to work on what Wesley might be thinking in that moment. I'm trying to teach her alertness. So what do you think Wesley might be thinking when you stick a no whining sticker on? And she said, well, I just wanted to give him a sticker. And I said, yes, yes, that's still about you. What do you think Wesley might be thinking in that moment? Well, but I love stickers. Yes, I understand that, but we're not thinking about you right now. What do you think? I want you to start a sentence with, Wesley might be thinking, instead of starting your sentence with, I go. And she finally got there after about four tries. But right, this is where we all start. And this is not because my daughter is inherently more selfish than anybody else. It's because she is in the process. We're all born largely being the most alert to what is going on inside of us. I remember seeing this quote in what was once a popular TV show. The main character was this wildly self-centered lawyer. And somebody just stops her and says, why is it that you think all of your problems are so much bigger than everybody else's? Do you ever want to ask somebody that, by the way? Let's just be honest. Sometimes you just feel like that. Why do you think your problems are? And her answer is profoundly honest. Because they're mine. Right? This is where we all start off in life. But we have the capacity, and to some, not to the same exact extent, some people are automatically better at this than others, but we all have the capacity to cultivate awareness. Awareness of what's going on in our immediate context, awareness of what's going on in our community, awareness of what's going on in our world. And this is the first step towards intercessory prayer. Intercessory prayer, in simple terms, is inviting God to change the world around you. Inviting God to change the world around you. But before we can invite God to change the world around us, we need to learn to pay attention to the world around us, right? We need to make sure we are actually asking God to do something about the way the world actually is. And so tonight, the first challenge I want to give you is this idea of waking up to the world around you. How do you do this? Just like Churchill, you develop systems and habits in your life. By the time he needed them, men automatically went to his house with information. He didn't have to do anything at that point. He'd done the work years before. By the time he needed them, media people and diplomats and politicians automatically knew Churchill was the guy to go to. And they literally would, I don't mean like figuratively they would show up at his door. His house was, he called his house Chartwell in it. Chartwell, they literally showed up at his door, knocking on the door saying, hey, I've got stuff for you. He cultivated systems of alertness. How do you do this in your life? Probably not by quite the same way Churchill did, but there are lots of things we can do. We can learn to listen to the news. Learn to listen to the news, and not just one-sided news. I dare you to listen. You can't. There's no such thing as well-balanced news, right? Like, that's not a thing. It doesn't exist. And so the only way to get that is to listen to both sides of the news and then compare and contrast what you're hearing, right? So, like, listen to CNN and Fox News, right, back to back. It'll be great. So listen to the news. That is one way to cultivate awareness. Read a newspaper once in a while. Look on a news website on a regular basis. Those are ways to cultivate awareness about what's going on. But there's more than that, too. I remember several years ago, we had just had this building for a year or two, and Pastor Kurt texted everybody on staff, and he said, hey, I want you to go out, take a walk for half an hour to an hour today, and I want you to be paying attention to what you think is the spiritual condition of the community we serve. Just go take a walk and pay attention. What I found interesting is that many of us came back with very similar answers. And I also find it interesting that some of the things that we saw on that walk are things we consistently, I hear Pastor Kerr, he won't say, hey, do you remember that walk when we did that thing? But I hear him use the language we started using after that fairly regularly to describe our community. When you take a walk intentionally paying attention, it's a whole different spiritual ballgame than when you're just walking from place to place because you got to get there, right? Because when you got to get there, whenever you're driving or walking because you're trying to get from point A to point B, we put our blinders on in order to not get distracted, right? Like, when you were coming to church, how many of you, we're going to have a little honest moment here. It's going to be good. How many of you were a little afraid you were running late to church tonight? A couple of people who aren't honest, and then some people who are raising their hands. That's good. When you're feeling late to someplace, you are not trying to pay attention to every detail of what's going by as you're walking or driving, right? Honestly, you are trying to, like, just focus. And that is as it should be. If you're running late, you don't want to, like, see 57,000 things. But if you go out and take a walk or take a drive specifically through one of our communities, and your whole goal is just to ask yourself the question, what can I see? And more to the point, to ask the question, God, what do you want me to see? God will show you things you have not seen before. Same is true, you know, one of the things I find fascinating is how many conversations can be happening when you're sitting in a barber chair, right? Like, there could be like a whole lot of conversations happening all around you. And in one moment, you could dismiss that all as idle chit-chat. But how much of that is a good barometer of what is going on in the community? How much of that is a good example of how people are thinking and feeling in our community? It may tell you an awful lot about what's going on just to listen to the things people are... I'll tell you what, you go get your hair cut 5 different times, people are talking about the same thing 5 different times, it might be a running issue in the community. Same thing, you listen at family gatherings or neighborhood gatherings or community gatherings, what are people talking about? Instead of just jumping in and trying to think, what can I say? You pause to listen. And in all of these moments, you're saying, God, what do you want to show me about my community? This is cultivating alertness. God is perfectly aware of every detail of everything that is happening in every place all of the time. He is fully aware. And so often it is our unawareness that limits our ability to intercede. And so God wants to challenge us in these verses, and I only picked 2 out of like 8 that I could have used. He said, you got to stay alert. Got to stay alert. Stay alert. Because in order to pray, you have to be an alert person. You cannot intercede for a world you are ignorant of. So challenge number 1, stay alert. But alert for what? Well, Matthew 26:41 gives us one answer. One answer is keep watch and pray, or stay alert and pray, so that you will not give in to temptation. I don't know if you know this, but you should never, ever, ever, ever be caught off guard or surprised when you are tempted. Why? Because it is absolutely inevitable. It is a guaranteed fact of human life that you will be tempted. It's just a thing. We should just treat it like normal. How do you treat temptation like it's normal? Being alert for it. Because I don't know if you've noticed, but temptation starts off this big and then ends up this big. If you're cultivating alertness for temptation, isn't it easier to say no when it's like little tiny at the beginning? So much easier. Cultivating alertness means you notice it when it's little tiny. And you get to say no when it's little tiny. So Jesus said, stay alert for temptation. Pay attention. This is how we personally pray for ourselves. Be alert for temptation and pray. God, if you don't know the ways you are going to be tempted, you need to write them down. Satan is not that clever. He probably tempts you 80% of the time, the exact same way over and over and over and over again. So again, we shouldn't be surprised. We should be praying every day. God, I know here are the things Satan's going to tempt me with, so help me with that. I don't have to wait for temptation. It's not like I'm wondering how Satan's going to tempt me. I know how Satan's going to tempt me. I know what my weak spots are. God, you got to help me with those. I need help with those now before I get tempted. every day, all the time. So he says, stay alert for temptation. But then the other thing I think is that we need to cultivate alertness for what I'm going to call the unwill of God. We need to cultivate an alertness for the unwill of God. Listen to one of the most famous verses in the Bible. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. May your kingdom come and your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. The obvious implication of that verse is that a lot of times the will of God is not being done on earth. It is always being done in heaven. That is what it means to be heaven. Heaven is the place God's will is done all of the time. If God's will were done on earth all of the time, we would not need to pray for that. But since our primary teaching on prayer from Jesus is to pray for the will of God to be done, we can assume that if praying is not happening, neither is the will of God. How is the will of God? Where is the unwill of God happening? All over the place. Think about all of the places in your personal life where the unwill of God is happening. Things that God would never want to have happen, that have happened in your past, that happen in your present, that might happen in your future. Think about your family and all of the ways the unwill of God might be striking your family. Think about your neighborhood. Can you think of some ways that the unwill of God is in action in your neighborhood? This is the one you'll catch if you go for a walk, by the way. I remember as I walked that day, noticing trash on the street and broken windows in a bunch of the houses and homes that were not being taken care of. I remember seeing like really little kids not being watched on any level by anybody. And I remember thinking, none of that is the will of God. God does not will that there be trash on the street, nor does he will that houses be treated like trash, nor does he will that children be treated like trash. These are not the will of God. That is the unwill of God in the neighborhood. What does the unwill of God look like at your work? Whether you work in an office or at a pizza place, as a taxi cab driver, or as a senator, what does the unwill of God look like where you're working? Where is God's will not reigning, not being followed? What about just locally, on a slightly bigger scale, in our community as a whole? Where is the unwill of God at work? Where is the political unwill of God happening? Where is the economic unwill of God happening? These are all great questions to be asking as we cultivate alertness for the unwill of God. Why? Because every place in the world that there is the unwill of God, we are taught to pray and pray. This is Ephesians 6:18, which is where we start. It says, pray in the Spirit at all times and on every occasion. Doesn't matter if you're in your personal life or your family life or your neighborhood or your work or in your local community or you're dealing with politics or economics. None of that matters. Pray all the time. For what? Everything you see that is not the will of God. Just pray for all of it. Cultivate. We talked last week about the idea of being aware of God's presence on a regular basis as we walk through life. This is part of how we do that. By attuning ourselves to the world around us and all of the things that are not the will of God. And you might think to yourself, yeah, but I don't know. That's okay, because what you're going to do once you decide something is the unwill of God is you're going to pray about it. You're going to ask God in concrete terms to fix it, which means if you are somehow wrong about what God's will is, it's okay, because God can filter that. Not your job to filter it. It's your job to start praying a lot. And as you pray and read the Bible, God will train you more and more. And this is important, by the way. You got to read the Word, guys. You need to be in the Bible enough on a regular, daily basis to get to know the character of God so that you can automatically know the unwill of God. Everybody thinks they automatically know the unwill of God, by the way. This is something people automatically, yeah, absolutely, God wouldn't want that. Absolutely, God wouldn't want that. I will tell you right now, I trust people who spend a lot of time with the Bible when they have those instincts a whole lot more than I trust people who do not spend a lot of time with the Bible when they have those instincts. Because those instincts must be refined by submitting them to the truth of God's word. So we're just cultivating our alertness for the unwill of God everywhere in the world so that we can pray over and over again. And sometimes it might be one thing that you're praying for weeks and weeks and weeks. You set aside special time to pray about. Other times it might be things that just you just mention it once to God in the middle of the day. God, I am looking at what is happening at that building, and that is not your will. I know that is not your will, so please come and fix it. And sometimes you might know what you want God to do. God, I want you to transform that building that is being used to sell drugs into a place where families are restored and healed and transformed. That's what I want you to do with that building. And you can be that specific. God, this part of the community is known for certain things that I know. Now, I'm not talking about this part of the community. There are specific places in our community you can walk by and say, God, I know this part of the community is famous for something, and that thing is the unwill of God. God, make this specific spot, this specific intersection, a place where people encounter the forgiveness and love that only you can offer. Change this spot. Change the reputation of this place. God, I know what happens in that part of my family, and I know parts of it are not the will of God. God, I pray that in my family, everybody would be loved the way you designed them to be loved. Whatever it is, be as specific as you can, but in the moments where you just, and it is okay to have these moments, there are moments where you think, I know that is not the will of God, but wow. God, that, no. And it is okay. Sometimes that's the prayer. God, that, no. And just maybe come back to it later, maybe you don't, but just, it's okay to say, God, I do not accept that because that is not the will of God. So we're cultivating an alertness to the unwill of God. And I want you to remember, as we think about this, this sounds heavy, doesn't it? This sounds pretty intense. This is not something that you would do on an evening when you're just relaxing in your chair. Like, this is not relaxation exercises that we're talking about. This is the kind of exercise you do if you believe that you are in the middle of a war. And so I challenge you to do it because we believe that we are in the middle of a war. That there is a very real enemy who actually wants to destroy every person in the world, and that he is doing a pretty good job. And that we want to take a stand and say we refuse to accept that. We reject the influence of the enemy in the world. We believe that God can transform and heal and restore. We believe that the power of God is enough to turn the tide and to change the balance of power in our world, and we are determined to ask him to do it. That is what intercessory prayer is all about. Winston Churchill knew he was in a war about 10 years earlier than anybody else. So he was able to be alert, to cultivate habits, to cultivate relationships that informed him of what he was going on, and he took a stand. And I love this verse as our parting thought here. Isaiah 62, 6 and 7, it says this. It says, O Jerusalem, I have posted watchmen on your walls that will pray day and night continually. What a beautiful image of alertness, right? Watchmen on the wall in war, looking for an enemy that is coming. But then here's the second half of it. I want you to hold on to this. Take no rest, all you who pray to the Lord, and give the Lord no rest until he completes his work. Part of intercessory prayer is you not resting. Part of it is knowing that it is our challenge, our command from the Bible, to not let God rest. It is your job to pester God until he acts. Sometimes we find ourselves asking the question, why didn't God do something? And there are dozens of honest answers to that. But I would like us to make a decision tonight to be committed to making sure that there is one answer that is never the case. I would like us to commit ourselves to never allowing it to be the case that when someone says, well, why didn't God act? I don't want us to answer because no one asked him to. Because of all the complicated reasons why God doesn't act, and it is a complicated thing, and I understand that, that is a stupid reason. And I don't think it should ever be a real one. If God is waiting for us to ask, let's ask about everything, all the time, in every situation, in every circumstance, and then watch what God is going to do.